Right. I was given a challenge by someone whom I shan't name, to deliver a sermon on the Song of Songs. Not a book you often hear about in a church service. I can only think of three times when I've heard it. All three of those were weddings. Two of them were in this church. The other one was Westminster Cathedral for a royal wedding. I like a challenge, so I did my reading and research. I've got some Bible study books, and there's a lot of information online. The only trouble was, with this book, every source I found seemed to take a different slant on the meaning and the characters, and it got a bit confusing. And then I came across one article that said something like this. This is a book that scholars disagree on. They disagree on what it means, what it's for, or even whether it should be in the Bible at all. There's no mention of God in there. All the other books of the Bible do, except for Ruth. There's some ambiguity over the title and who wrote it and exactly when. And then there's the debate about whether there's three main characters or two. Is it actually just a poem? Is there a linear storyline in it? Maybe it's a collection of related poems. Is it just meant to be enjoyed as a kind of mystery or analysed in some way for some deeper meaning? Is it about sexual attraction, human love more generally, or something even deeper? So, quite a challenge, and I must admit it did have me worried at the beginning when I was trying to figure out what to do with this. So many questions about this enigmatic book, and scholars have been trying to interpret them on and off for thousands of years. I found one from some French philosopher 1,000 years ago, but it didn't help me. But with God's help, I'm going to give it a go this morning and give you some of my thinking, and take it from other people, obviously. But spoiler alert here, I don't have answers to all of this. But first, is there anybody here under the age of 18? Okay, that's good. I thought I'd better raise this, because the subject matter is of an adult nature, although perhaps given Milford's demographics, I should have put up a warning about weak hearts and getting overexcited. We've got some first aiders. You're on standby. Even if you are underage, or if you're not, you should take heed of the warnings placed repeatedly at intervals throughout the text. Daughters of Jerusalem, I charge you by the gazelles and by the does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. I charge you by the gazelles and does of the field, do not arouse or awaken love until it so desires. Well, I interpret that as meaning there's a right time, place, and person to fall in love with and act upon it. And we're talking about romantic love in this instance. Don't rush in too soon and don't act without love. That applies to us all, no matter our age. And don't act without love? That's a good advice generally. Anyway, that's the classification warning out of the way. Let's start with the title, shall we? The phrase Song of Songs is generally taken to mean the greatest of all songs. It's a phraseology you see quite a bit in the Bible. Lord of Lords, Host of Hosts. Song of Songs, the best song, the greatest song. In today's parlance, we'd probably call it GOAT, greatest of all time, G-O-A-T. But I don't like that. But then the first line says Solomon's Song of Songs. That implies he wrote it. After all, we know he wrote many songs and proverbs. It says so in the Book of Kings. But it is a bit odd if he did, because the main character in the book is a woman. She speaks nearly twice as much as the man, and she starts and finishes the dialogue. Not that there's anything unusual about a woman having the last word. It's perhaps unusual in ancient texts. But it does mean that the book seems to be more about her than him. And Solomon never speaks. In fact, he's never referred to directly, it's always indirectly. So he's got a secondary role to the shepherd, her beloved, unless you take the view that the shepherd is in fact Solomon in disguise, or that this is Solomon wishing he were just a lowly shepherd, and not a rich and powerful king, and that he had somebody that loved him just for who he was, and not for all his riches. And towards the end, it's critical of Solomon's many marriages, which were not for love. The other thing you have to bear in mind is that in the ancient Aramaic, in which it was originally written, the words are actually the other way round. It's Song of Songs of Solomon. And in the Aramaic, rather like the Greek, in Greek you have the word se, which means of, but it also means to, which, by, on. It can mean all sorts of things. And it's the same with the Aramaic. So this is Song of Songs of Solomon, or Song of Songs to do with Solomon. So it could be that he wrote it, or maybe he chose it or selected it as his favourite, or it was written in the style of or in homage to Solomon and all his wisdom. Maybe he wrote it, or maybe not. As it refers to him, it must have been written perhaps during his reign or perhaps shortly after. But that's about all we can say for sure. Perhaps I should give you some background on King Solomon the Wise. There's a picture of him by Simeon Solomon. He probably didn't look like that. I mean, that picture was done in 1872. But this is the thing. When King David was very old, his eldest son, Adonijah, wanted to be named king. And he gathered his other brothers and various officials to a feast and to proclaim himself king. But he did not ask his younger half-brother, Solomon, nor the prophet Nathan to the feast. So when Nathan found out about it, he went to see Bathsheba, Solomon's mother, and they both went off to see the king. And King David was persuaded to keep his earlier promise and declare Solomon as his successor, which he did. Soon after, David died, Solomon became king. Then Solomon killed his half-brother for plotting against him. He also took revenge on Joab and some others who had previously plotted against his father. This was as David had requested of him before he died. And he killed off some other people as well, basically wiping out all his opposition. He then went on to marry the king of Egypt's daughter, not for love, but for the purpose of a powerful alliance, the first of many. Not what you'd expect of a dedicated follower of God, is it? Then, though, he had a dream. And in his dream, God asked him, Solomon, what do you want? And Solomon asked, not for riches and power, but for wisdom. Wisdom to rule rightly. And this is his epiphany. God is pleased with his answer. So God grants him his wish. And so he becomes known as Solomon the Wise. And you have the well-known stories about the two mothers with the one baby. And also the Queen of Sheba coming to test him and finding that his wisdom far exceeded all that she'd been told. God blessed Solomon with wisdom. And through him, the people were blessed and prospered. So Solomon finished the temple to the Lord, built a great palace, and grew the empire, and looked after its people. He composed 3,000 proverbs and more than 1,000 songs. You can read all that in 1 Kings. But then he turned away from God's laws. He was extremely rich. He had 700 wives. These were the princesses and women he'd married from rich families. And he had 300 concubines. Those are his secondary wives or common law wives from the lesser families. I'm not going to try and explain all that. He ruled successfully, fairly and wisely, sort of. Both King David before he died and the Lord had warned him several times, if you obey my laws and commands, I will do for you what I promised your father, David. Those are the words from 1 Kings 6:12. If you obey all my laws and commands. God warned him not to amass too many riches or too many wives. But that's exactly what he did. And in the end, he ended up building altars and making burnt offerings to other gods to keep his foreign wives happy. I can't begin to imagine how difficult it would be to keep 1,000 wives happy. One is fine, I just made that clear. One wife is not a problem. But 1,000? God wasn't happy with him either, but decided to let him live out his life regardless. And after 40 years of rule, he died and was buried in David's city. And his son Rehoboam succeeded him as king. You can read all that in 1 Kings 11. But Rehoboam didn't rule for long. He lacked his father's wisdom, and the rebellion and worship of other gods and religions that had begun under Solomon flourished, while Israel did not. But that's another story. Some people have suggested that Solomon wrote Song of Songs in his youth about his first real love. Possible. Or alternatively, that it was in his old age, wishful thinking, looking back. Neither of those fits with 1 Kings to me, not given his first marriage to the king of Egypt's daughter and 700 wives, 300 concubines. But anyway, Solomon may have been wise king for much of his rule, but to me it's like the wisdom God granted him in his youth gradually left him in his old age as he turned further and further away from God. Now, another important question, I think, to ask before we get more deeply into the scripture is, was Song of Songs typical love poetry of the time? I mean, it perhaps looks a bit odd, not so much the passage that Jenny read, that's quite a straightforward passage, but as you go through it's only 8 books, it's an easy read, it does get a bit strange in places though. So, for centuries, Song of Songs was thought to be the oldest love poem in existence, but it's not. Archaeologists in the 19th and early 20th century found older poetry, love poetry. Here's one from ancient Egypt around 1370 BC, so that's about 400 years before Solomon. And there are a few others like this one, and maybe they were used during wedding ceremonies. The oldest known love poem is this one, The Love Song for Shu Sin, and it is an erotic love poem, written in about 2000 BC, more than 1,000 years before Solomon. And it's written in the ancient Sumerian cuneiform, basically shapes carved into stone. And it goes something like this, Bridegroom, dear to my heart, goodly is your beauty, honey sweet. Lion, dear to my heart, goodly is your beauty, honey sweet. And then it goes on. The thing that struck me when I did some research into these other ancient poems is that they lack the literary depth you find in Song of Songs. Yes, these older poems have imagery of lions, honey, crocodiles, and a description of the desire love brings. And I'm no expert, and I'm probably oversimplifying things here, but the structure and style of all the other ones I found is very similar, and the meaning pretty superficial, straightforward. I would summarize it like this. The woman says to the man, you look good to me. The man says to the woman, you're not so bad yourself. And the poem goes on and usually ends up with them making their way to the bedchamber. I mean, the meaning is pretty obvious, and I think these are more lust than love, don't you think? You compare that to Song of Songs, much more complex, more newest comparisons. There's an ebb and flow of the relationship between the man and the woman as she loses him and finds him again. There are warnings. There's interaction and reference to friends and family. I don't think Song of Songs looks much like these other ancient poems. Much more closer, if you like, to our modern day love poems, like those of Shakespeare or Byron, or maybe triggering emotions in like some of our love songs like My Funny Valentine or Can't Help Falling in Love. And unlike these other ancient poems, Song of Songs has been used as a key source in a number of TV shows, films, and books. All is good inspiration. I don't see the Love Song for Shu Sin being used for anything except maybe on a Valentine's Day card. So, Song of Songs may not be the oldest love poem, and maybe some of the elements the Israelites picked up from ancient Egyptian poetry. But it's much more than that, and it definitely deserves to be on a top 10 list somewhere. So, let's move on to the scripture. This is my summary of the storyline, just to give you the whole picture of the whole book. And remember, it's a poem. There's repetition, and it jumps around from scene to scene. There are references to named flowers, dances, and gardens. These might have had a specific meaning or purpose in the ancient culture of the day, and we've lost those with time. So, I've simplified it down to one slide. I hope it makes sense. She starts by confessing that she's in love with him. Your name is like perfume poured out. And the friends approve. We rejoice and delight in you. But then she's worried. Maybe she's not good enough. Do not stare at me because I am dark. He likes her, and he tells her that she is beautiful, and they go on to describe each other. I am a rose of Sharon. That's a flower, by the way. My beloved is like to me a sachet of myrrh. I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses. What? You liken her to a horse? Guys, I would not recommend you liken your better half to a horse. Not even a Grand National. I really don't think that would go down well. I think you have to bear in mind the context. 3,000 years ago, horses were a luxury item, a valued possession, especially for transport. Pharaoh would have had the best of the best, the horse of horses, if you like, and they would have been treated like royalty, a lot better than most of the people of the time. So he's not telling her she looks like a horse. He's saying that she's highly regarded, a valuable possession, somebody special. I'm not sure what the modern day equivalent would be. Maybe a sleek sports car? No, I'm on dangerous ground here. I'm going to move on. She wakes up alone, and she goes to look for him, and is found by the watchman. Solomon's gold and silver carriage appears. Now, you have to think also that in ancient Jewish culture, when a bride and groom got married, they were thought of as king and queen for the day. So there is some link here. Is this just the wedding ceremony, or is this really Solomon's carriage? They're together again, and he describes her beauty in rather strange terms. Eyes like doves, hair like goats, teeth like sheep. Hold on to that. I'll come back to this. Anyway, it moves on. They're now married and living together. Well, they both say they've been to the garden and tasted its fruits, so make of that what you will. Now she's in bed again. He knocks, but she doesn't answer, not straight away. And when she does, he's gone. So she goes to look for him again. But this time, when the city guards find her, they beat her. Eventually, she finds him in the garden, and he describes her beauty again. They redeclare their love for each other. Their love is like a vineyard, and my own vineyard is mine to give. I belong to my beloved. There's also a line in here about coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved. I think that suggests they're older now, a mature couple walking arm in arm, supporting each other. And immediately after that line, she claims their love is as strong as death, burning like fire still. Waters cannot quench, nor rivers sweep away, nor money buy. Love as strong as death, burning like fire. But then it appears they are once more apart. He's calling to her, let me hear your voice. And she to him, come away with me, my beloved. And that's where it ends. So, as you can probably see, it's a little bit difficult to follow as a storyline, and I've had to miss lots of bits out, otherwise it would get a bit disjointed. But hopefully it gives you some sense of it. But there is another way I can summarise the entire text for you, and it's using a bit of technology. This is a word cloud. Now, if you don't know what a word cloud is, what I've done is I've fed all the words from Song of Songs into this machine. It ignores all the little words, like at, the, on, to. On all the longer words, it counts how many times they appear. And the more time that word appears, the bigger and more centrally that word is displayed in the word cloud. So what that gives you is a statistical summary of what the text contains. Kind of a sense of what this text is about, without any details, without any timeline, but just a sense of what it's saying by virtue of how many times a word appears. And in this instance, I think it works really, really well. Because what I see in that is this. My beloved is like many, many, many beautiful different things. My beloved is like many beautiful things. And if I had to summarize the poem in one sentence, I can't think of a better way to do that. My beloved is like so many beautiful things. Picture paints a thousand words. Now, some people have looked into Song of Songs and they've analysed it for other meanings, for allegories, alternative interpretations, if you like. And one suggested allegory is that it's really about God and his love for his people. And this sometimes is referred to as the Old Testament or Jewish allegory, because it fits with the Old Testament, obviously. In this, the man, the shepherd, is God, and his chosen people are the bride. And then the story becomes about God's unfailing love for his people, despite our failings sometimes. We were made by love. We were made to love and be loved, and not just husband and wife. We do lose our way from time to time. We get lost and suffer, like the woman being beaten by her brothers or by the guards. But God is always there and always accepts us back again. And though we battle against our selfish nature, we have this inbuilt desire to find that perfect love and to be closer to God. Take me away with you. Let the king bring me into his chambers. That line could indicate a desire to be close to God or be in his presence. And also, the woman describes herself as being dark, dark like the tents of Kedar. Kedar was a nomadic wandering tribe, which probably had dark rustic tents made of goat hair, nothing like the luxurious curtains in King Solomon's royal temple. And if you read Psalm 120, verse 5, you'll see the psalmist lamenting living among the tents of Kedar, indicating feelings of being alienated or separated from God. So again, we have this idea about being separated and then brought back into close contact with God. So that allegory does work to some degree with some of the verses, but I don't think it works for the whole book. Why the warnings, for example? Why all the other goings on, like Solomon's chariot appearing or the friends calling the Shulamite girl back? There's another suggested allegory, and this time it's all about Jesus. In this, Jesus is the shepherd, and of course, he's also royalty, and we are the bride, his church. And that's echoed in Paul's word in Ephesians 5:25, describing a husband's love for his wife as a symbol of Christ's love for the church. And in John 7:34, for example, that seems to echo the bride searching for a husband. I delight to sit in his shade. Let him lead me to the banquet hall, and let his banner over me be love. Listen, my beloved is knocking. Those are all phrases I think you could relate to Jesus, or find similar words elsewhere in the New Testament. And of course, at the end, the husband and wife are calling to each other to be again, to be together again. And similarly, we Christians are waiting for Jesus to return. If it's a metaphor for the church, then the black tents could represent the trials of life and perseverance, and the curtains of Solomon symbolizing the connection with God's presence and glory. So, again, many of the verses you could link that way. But then who are the friends? Why is it the bride who's beaten? Why would Jesus describe us as being better than 60 queens and 80 concubines? There's lots of phrases in there that don't seem to match that allegory. I think it's a stretch to use the whole book to map onto those two ideas. And then you've got the fact that, sort of the issue that some people think that Solomon is the shepherd in disguise, or that the Shulamite girl is in love with the shepherd, but she's been married off to Solomon, and she runs off to her lover, and that's why she's beaten. That stuff gets very complicated, and I'm not going to go into those. If you want to look into more detail of that, I think choose that as a topic for your Bible study or house group, because there's a lot to it. I'm going to go with the fact that given love poetry was part of the ancient culture in the region, I take the view that this is exactly what it says it is. It's an Israelite love poem. reflecting on the divine gift of love and how well that is illustrated in the love between two people and the journey they take from their first meeting, getting married, and living married life together. There are powerful echoes as you read the text of Adam and Eve and the Garden of Eden, many references to a garden or vineyards, to flowers and tasty fruits. And Adam and Eve, of course, were the first married couple and part of God's creation plan. Eve was made as a lifelong companion for Adam. They were meant to be together, as are this couple. The story is about how the way God intended things to be, a lifelong, lasting, deep love the two people have for one another. The poem flows back and forth between the man's voice and the woman's voice, shifting from scene to scene, a complex tapestry of events like living out a life, not really any clear linear sequence. We see some repeated themes, though. We see the desire and joy of them being together, and the ache of being apart and needing to search for one another. Their love is ever-present, regardless of time passing, regardless of the distance by which they're separated. Love is always there. But there's some strange images and metaphors in this Hebrew poetry, and they're not primarily visual. If they were, they would be pretty strange. You have to focus on the meaning behind these images. Now, I warn you, the next slide is a bit scary. I said I'd come back to this. At one point, the man describes the woman as a menagerie of animals and other objects. Eyes like doves, hair like goats, teeth like sheep, and a neck made of bricks. I mean, this is why I think you miss the point if you think Song of Songs is erotic poetry or the Christian Kama Sutra. It's not. You couldn't call these descriptions erotic. You have to think about the meaning behind them. In ancient cultures and still today, doves are widely thought of as symbols of peace, love, and new beginnings. And in many cultures, they can be associated with communication, perhaps between spiritual and earthly, divine messages between spiritual and earthly realms. They represent deliverance and forgiveness. And in some cultures, it's a symbol of the groom's commitment to care for the bride and her family. So when he says your eyes are like doves, perhaps he's saying, when I look at you, you bring peace and new beginnings. Now, I don't know whether any of you have been up a mountain and seen a flock of sheep or goats descending down the valley as the day comes to an end and the sun starts to set. I have. It's a beautiful sight. There's something mesmerizing, almost magical about these different elements of nature working together. The movement of the goats, which is both random yet coordinated as they sure-footedly make their way down the goat paths, and the sounds and the changes of colour of light, and how the world stills as the day comes to an end. It's absolutely beautiful. So I get the one about the goats. The sheep and the pomegranates, I'll leave you to figure those out. But it's obviously a positive description, something about how it makes him feel. So my point is, these descriptions, it's not about raw physical attraction, like the other poetry you heard. It's not naked attraction or Love Island. Far from it. It's about how they feel about one another and the character they see in each other. Let me make two other points from Scripture. She begins early on by saying, his name is like perfume. Just hearing his name is going to make her feel heady. And there are various other Old Testament references that say similar things. In Ecclesiastes, a good name is better than fine perfume. And in Proverbs 22, a good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver and gold or gold. In ancient times, a person's name was really important. It often embodied their character or related to events that occurred in a person's life. But what does she mean when she says, your name is like a fine perfume I can smell? Well, I think she's saying she's not interested in how rich he is or how many horses or sheep he has. It's just the thought of him that has her under his spell. It's enough to hear his name for all those positive feelings develop inside her thinking about the person that he is. Then she goes on to say, "Do not stare at me because I am dark. I've had to work the fields. You probably haven't noticed me amongst the other women." She declared her love for him in the previous verses, but now she seems worried. She's just a working class agricultural labourer. She's not in his league. But look at how he answers that. He's not just throwing out random compliments. He's actually listened to what she said, and he's answering her concerns. "I have noticed you," he said. "I have noticed you. You are something special." Okay, a horse. But stay with me on this. "Your skin may be dark from the sun, but your face is beautiful, your cheeks and your earrings. And if you don't have gold and silver earrings yet, you will have when we're together. We have a great life in store together, full of hope." And the poem goes on, describing their relationship, and rather like our modern day marriage vows, for better or worse, richer or poorer, they face ups and downs, but their love is always there and deep rooted. The love they have stays even in their later married life. So there you have it, a love poem about a man and a woman, with a rather complex and perhaps multifaceted text, leading itself to various interpretations, something of a mystery, but then you might say that about love. Ultimately, though, I think it's a celebration of human love being the divine gift from God, and a reflection of God's intense love for you and I. I sometimes think we both overuse and underuse the word love in the English language. I can say, "I love fish and chips. I love playing my trumpet. I love my wife. I love the Lord." Those are all very different types of love. And we tend to use the love quite free and easily when we're talking about objects, a favourite dish, a favourite dress, a TV programme. Less so, I think, for many of us when we're talking about other people, unless it's our nearest and dearest. You might feel a bit uncomfortable saying "I love you" to a friend or a neighbour, because it kind of has romantic connotations that you don't mean. But if we just focus on love being a positive relationship between individuals that helps, supports and encourages one another, that's the love more generally that I think we're talking about. God loved us when he created us human beings in the beginning. He loved us when he sent Jesus to save us. And we are blessed with the capacity to love and the desire to love and be loved. And not just romantic husband and wife type love. The text in Song of Songs mentions and hints at the love of friends, of family, siblings and parents. Romantic love is just part of the spectrum. And if you've seen or experienced that lifelong love between a husband and wife, like in the story, you know the strong depth of love. And that's the sort of depth of love God has for us. We Christians are commanded to love one another, are we not? There's a lot of love in this church, I'm pleased to say. And I know people outside our church sometimes refer to us as a friendly church. And I think that's a good thing. I've been a visitor to many churches where all I've got is a hello and goodbye on the door. But here we do more than that, which is good. But how much more wonderful could it be if we were known by people outside as a loving church? What would that look like? We can smile and say hello to people and chat with people. What if we really, really listened to people? Not just heard the words, but really listened and tried to understand where they're coming from. What if we demonstrated a heart of compassion and a heart of forgiveness? What if we really push the boundaries on serving and encouraging one another and people outside? Then might we be known as a loving church. Jesus told us to love God and love our neighbours as ourselves. Yes, we have to love ourselves too. And he commanded us to love one another for love comes from God. And Paul wrote much about the importance of love, faith, hope, but above all else, love. If you act without love, what have you got? Not much. The world outside is sadly short of love today. I see it, I'm sure you do, in the news headlines. I mean, there's military conflicts. What saddens me as much as the conflicts out there and the suffering, the damage and the hurt, it's the total lack of love when they interview people from both sides. The hate one group of people has to another that causes the war in the first place. And we get a lot of aggression these days around political beliefs and towards our politicians. And the fact that our prisons are full and we have knife crime and misogyny in our schools, these are all signs of a society that's lacking in love, I feel. And some of it I blame on social media. Social media should spread goodness and kindness, but without any moral compass or soul to it, and with the algorithms that are written into it, it only seems to amplify our inherent and sinful nature, which is a shame. We as Christians, I feel, should be a shining light in this darkness. Yes, we can be angry and disagree over things, but let's not forget love. I know it's hard to do sometimes. Stuff gets in the way and we don't always react in a positive way to others, depending upon how we're feeling. I'm guilty of that, but we must try. We should be showing love, kindness, gentleness, helpfulness, fruits of the Spirit. We should show them more. And it should be above what the norm that society expects. And in circumstances where people aren't expecting it, non-believers should notice a difference about the way we behave. And if they ask why, we can tell them. We love because he loved us first, like a husband loves his wife. Right, two more slides and then I'm finished. You remember the word cloud? I fed Song of Songs into a word cloud generator. Well, I thought if I've done that with scripture, I ought to do that with my sermon. So, if any of you nodded off, or daydreamed, or missed bits, or worried you can't remember what my sermon was about, come tomorrow. It's there in summary. It was all about love. Simple as that. And then finally, I'm going to finish with the words of Bishop Curry, the words he used at the beginning of his royal wedding. There is power in love. Don't underestimate it. Don't even over-sentimentalize it. There's power. Power in love. Not just in its romantic forms, but in any form, any shape of love. When someone cares for you and you know it, when you love and you show it, it actually feels right. There's something right about it. And the reason for it? The reason has to do with the source. We were made by the power of love. The source of love is God Himself. As Martin Luther King Jr. said, we must discover the power of love, the redemptive power of love. And when we do that, we will make this old world a new world. Love is the only way.